Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts as they share with you the insider's guide to property investing.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch, your insider's guide to property investing. I'm Bryce Holdaway, the co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel. And he's Ben Kingsley, the chair of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia and the current Property Investment Advisor of the Year. How are you, mate?
Good, Bryce. How are you?
Very well. We've had a busy week this week. We are in our constant mission to stay on top of what is happening in this country in terms of property investing. We went to the often forgotten but interesting place of Adelaide this week to check out what the property market's like over there.
Yeah, we did. So, I mean, at the end of the day, property investment's about a return on investment. And again, we're big on borderless investing because the timing of the market's going to be really important. And so we obviously know that Adelaide has had a soft period of time. But historically, we also know through our research that when other markets move and affordability becomes the conversation piece, then people look to migrate into those locations, and as long as all the other alignments are there, and you don't have to look at the broader market, you can actually get to more granular levels. There's going to be buying opportunities in those areas. And so what do? 5 or 6 field trips a year, don't we? We just get into new markets and have a look around?
We do. We're really lucky. We had we put out all the big guns in Adelaide as well. We brought the property professor, gave us 2 days of his time, Peter Kalouzos.
Yes.
Who's a very, very sharp operator over there in South Australia. And he showed us around his backyard. And surprise, surprise, Ben, it was interesting to note that even in Adelaide, which is often forgotten by property investors, a beautiful place to go to, by the way, for all of our South Australian listeners. I go there on the show regularly, but often forgotten by property investors outside of South Australia. But here's the deal. Location still does 80% of the heavy lifting in Adelaide as well.
It does. Surprise, surprise, surprise. I mean, Pete's a great operator. I've got a lot of respect for Peter and his insights into how you invest, and he's got some great books. So if you're looking to build your knowledge, check out two of Peter's books. They're really, really great work. And he's a terrific operator, and he's very generous with his time. And like he likes to have meetings of the mind around property investment and, you know, keeping, as you say, what is it, iron sharpens iron. So to share that knowledge with him and other great people like Margaret and Damien Collins at Momentum Wealth and Brad Beer and you know, Steve Waters at Select Right, those guys, Right Property Group, they're the types of people. There's some really cracking people out in the industry who know what they're talking about. So we obviously like working with those people and sharing some insights, because it's a big market out there. There's enough stock for the right people to know what to buy. And so we get out there and share that knowledge. And that correlates to obviously the returns we get for our clients. So from that point of view, it's always handy to be in a position to be able to work with those great people.
Yeah, agreed. No, it was well, even just the car chatter, we got to, you know, have afternoon tea and just pick his brain. So he's definitely a sharp mind. So Peter, thank you if you're listening. Thanks very much for hosting us in Adelaide and showing us some great spots. We saw, I guess incidentally, Ben, we saw, you know, we saw apartments, we saw flats, we saw townhouse developments, we saw big, beautiful period homes. We
subdivisions, just, development sites, a whole lot.
It was well worth a couple of days spent there, and we look forward to sort of going around the country and doing sort of recce missions in other parts of the world as well. What we want to chat about today is to say thanks very much to our listeners for all of the questions that they've asked, and we've now got a few that we want to get through today.
Q&A day.
We know that the feedback from the last one we did was really good, so we're going to get straight into it. The first one is regarding, well, the overarching context of this question is regarding building a pest inspection. So really like hearing your views on getting pre-purchase building and pest inspections done. And this is from Mark. Since the inspection industry isn't regulated, anyone could say they're a building and pest inspector. So how do I find a quality inspector? Ben?
Look, I think one of the best ways is to understand from a registration and qualification point of view, the things that I'm looking for is someone who has been a previous builder. So I want them to be a licensed builder, and I want them to have around 5 years, minimum 5 years experience as a builder. and to see that if in the state that they're working in, if there is some regulation and qualification that they need to do, that they've done that, you know, so they're qualified to give the report that they're about to give. Obviously, anyone who's read a property inspection report, it's laced with disclaimers and sort of protection mechanisms for them, and unfortunately, we live in a litigious society, so that's what happens. But in real terms, I want to be able to have experience, qualification, and then finally for me, I want to be able to talk to them. I want to be able to say, well, okay, cut through the long-winded 60 pages or whatever you're presenting me and say, is this a good property or not? You know, and to make sure that they're honest about that appraisal. So is it a go or is it a no?
Yeah.
And when you get that confidence around it, and obviously we do heaps and heaps of these each week for the properties we're buying for our clients, that's what we're looking for.
I agree. The to have one of these guys as part of your professional team is really important. I'll give you an example. This week I looked at a property in a really cracking suburb of Melbourne. It's on the north side in Ascot Vale. And it's a beautiful townhouse that unfortunately has a bit of a sad story that goes behind it, where the lady who was living there passed last year. She had between 20 and 30 animals in the house. And then nobody went and checked the property for a couple of months after she passed. So you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
They've spent $22,000 bringing it up to the point where I looked at it 2 days ago, and it's going to scare most people off.
Yeah.
So what I did is I called my building guy, who does all the building and pest inspections for me. I said, can you go through and have a look at this, please, and let me know how much it's going to cost to take the plaster down, maybe redo the tiling, just because it's the bones and the structure and the location is outstanding. But people who walk through, look through, they do a U-turn and they go out.
Yeah.
Whereas we want to see an opportunity, because if its end value is, we think it'd be about 820, you might need to spend 50 on it.
Yep.
You could pick it up in the high sixes, very early sevens. There's an opportunity there.
Equity harvesting right there.
Straight away. And just because you can see a bit outside the square. So the fact that I've got that person on my team, and to pick up on your point, is the fact that you can talk to them is critical, because I always say to clients when I'm engaging them, you know, as we've known from these podcasts, I'm 100% about getting established properties. So one of the things I do up front is I say to the client, listen, we are going to be buying an established property, probably 10 years plus older, 10 years plus old. So please have an expectation that when we get a building and pest inspection done, we are doing two things. We're trying to make sure A, it's not riddled with termites, or B, it's not going to fall over. But don't think that there's going to be a clean bill of health, because there will be something. So the fact that you can pick up the phone and talk to your building and pest inspector and say, hey, I know that you've got to protect yourself by, in writing, tell me all these things, but tell me, is there anything that's, you know, to use your terms, critical, important, nice to do? Which parts are reasons why I shouldn't go ahead?
Yeah.
And which are the reasons why I should just use it as a leverage point during negotiation?
Yeah, I bought a period home in Sydney, and it was one of the first purchases. I was probably in my mid-20s, and I've got the building inspection done, and I'm reading through it, and it's the same sort of thing. I'm thinking, God, I'm reading this is like it's falling down. So I had to pick up the phone, and I wanted to talk to him, and he was a bit harder to get in contact with, and he was quite restrictive in what he was saying. But I got the theme of what he was saying. Like, I can't give away all of it, because even what I say might be used against me in a court of law. But he was like, you know, I got to the point where I'm understanding your theme here. It's actually quite a sound property, but it needs a bit of work, because it's, you know, I think it was a 1908, you know, sort of semi-detached. And so I'm like, okay, yeah, the brickwork's exposed and there's going to be some mortar that falls. Yep, that's all good. And the roof, yep, I was familiar with that. I knew I need to spend 12 grand on the roof. Perfect, I'm lining it all up, the ducks line up. Yep, it's not going to fall over on me. No, it's not going to fall over. Great, okay, we go ahead. And, you know, that property I paid $395,000 for in 2001, and it's probably sold for $1 million today.
It's the best insurance policy I can think of, because I recently, with a client, went to buy a property in inner western Melbourne. It was a beautiful, single-fronted, Hawthorn brick, Victorian property. It was amazing. And on the day, I'll rewind. We put a building and pest inspection in, and what we found was the footings in one of the supporting walls was shot. So I'm not afraid of buying a property, a period home that's got stump issues because we can just get it done.
These days, relatively inexpensive, you know, a couple of $1,000s.
But the footings was another story, and my builder just said, Bryce, I'm really nervous about this one. Just don't go ahead.
Yep.
And for $400...
Best bit of advice
you've got. But at the time you think, I've got to spend $400. So if any listener is thinking, should I, shouldn't I can assure you that you should. Because I went to the auction that day. It was a freezing cold Melbourne day. There was nine bidders. It was a football crowd. It was unbelievable how many people were there. The real estate agent needed about six or seven scribes to help them capture all the bids. And I spoke to the agent a couple of days after the auction. I said, "What just happened there?" And he just said, "Look, the lady who bought it for $736, when all of the my comp work thought $660 would be a premium, $736." She goes, "She turned up on that day and bought it that day."
Oh no!
And I'm just thinking, how many people, like, because you're just so in this industry, and you just think, doesn't everyone get a building and pest inspection done? But not everyone does.
So she's going to be up for the surprise of her life when she works out that she's got a footings issue.
Well, she paid a premium, and if she isn't prepared to renovate it straight away, she's going to have ongoing issues, and that's the worst. When you buy something and you've got to throw money at it, where all you're doing, like. Happy to throw money at an air conditioner because it'll improve the rent. You're happy to throw money at a dishwasher because it'll improve the rent. Happy to throw money at a bedroom because it's going to improve. But if you're just throwing money to get yourself back to ground zero, boy, oh boy.
Yep, crazy.
That's the worst part. Okay, so the further extension of that is, given the amount they charge and the market being so hot with auctions, how do I ensure I don't burn through my deposit money when constantly missing out at auctions? I could end up wasting thousands on inspections until actually I win at auction. Great question, and lots to talk about.
Yeah, there is. And the reality is in a hot market, i.e. a seller's market that we're in Melbourne and Sydney at the moment, you need to understand your values. Mm. You need to be realistic about where this will end up. If they're quoting high fives, it's probably going to end up high sixes these at the moment. So you need to be making sure that you're in the game. So from an affordability point of view, if you're in the game and you expect it to go, you know, upwards of even 20% on what the quoted price range is, then it might be worth putting your pen to paper and signing off on a building and pest at that point, as opposed to we get a lot of feedback in the industry about underquoting and that type of thing. And I say most of the time it's because people really don't know where the value is at for that particular opportunity. Sometimes people don't also recognise that that it has potential to be a development site. So people are going to pay an absolute premium for it, knock it over, put maybe a splitter on it or a duplex on it or something along those lines. So the reality is you want to try and get a good relationship with the agent and just try to hopefully they'll be an honest agent and sort of saying, am I wasting my money in terms of doing this? I mean, am I in the hunt or am I outside of the hunt? If you don't know what you're doing, if you haven't engaged a buyer's agent, that's basically what I'd be doing, but that's a good segue over to you in terms of...
That was going to be my point, is if you're in one of the tough markets of Melbourne and Sydney, and I say tough because it's uber competitive, consider a buyer's agent. If you're not in those cities, for example, when I'm buying in Brisbane, I make my offers subject to a building and pest inspection. So I don't incur the cost unless I get the deal done. So if I'm in Perth or if I'm in Adelaide or if I'm in Darwin or if I'm in a regional town or I'm in Brisbane, I can not burn through my cash. But that's probably the biggest, for me, I can understand underquoting from an agent's perspective because it's their job to try and get a price best for their client. And the way they do that is attract the maximum amount of people. What I have a problem with underquoting is when the poor old buyer burns through cash when they were never in the hunt. And this is a case when they would. So two things to that part, get a buyer's agent to help you out. Or if you're not going to get a buyer's agent to help you out, make sure you understand recent relevant sales within the last 3 months in the area that you're looking to buy, not what the agent's quoting as a guide and not what other listing prices are at the moment, because they're a poor way to find out what real value is.
And here's a little bit of gold, guys. If you're not sure, approach the agent. Because when the agent's actually spoken to the vendor, they would have given them some comparative properties in terms of comparative properties in which they've told the vendor what to expect from a sales point of view. So if you ask a direct question of an agent, not rudely, but politely, am I in the hunt? What are you, you know, what have you comparatively, what's that word?
Comparatively
used. then that's going to be a good sign because they hopefully will give some indication of where they expect it to end up. So that's a great way of then saying, okay, well, it's still in within my budget, so I'm going to push the button on a building and pest report as opposed to going in blind. Because the reality is the agent does know where they hope it's going to end up. And if some agents are actually now inside some open homes are putting some comparative property sales out there for people to look at, to set that expectation. And I think if you speak to great leaders in the real estate agent industry, such as John McGrath, he would say that should be done. Mm. You know, he's not a big fan of underquoting. He thinks it should be a transparent and professional approach as opposed to quote it low and watch it go to get interest. So I think that's a good message to sort of say, well, what do you compare this with, or what streets or what properties that you might compare this with, is a bit of gold for our listeners.
I agree. Yeah, find out what you can from the agents will often want to give you as much information to try and get you to turn up and compete. But if you ask them direct questions like what Ben said, or I like to say, have you set the reserve with the owner and where do you think that might be? Mm. Because they probably won't answer that, but they're not likely to give you a lie in that regard. And as Ben said, an extension of what he said is I say, what do you think is the most relevant comp that stacks up this property here? Because their professional integrity is on the line. So whilst they're happy to give you some comparables, generally, if you specifically ask them what one do you think specifically matches up with this one, chances are you'll get a little bit more quality information. So good questions there from Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for that. We've unpacked a bit. Now, the other one is regarding rent vesting, Ben. I guess it's Gen Y investing as well. Typically, not exclusively, but typically the Gen Ys are doing a lot of this.
They are. In fact, I was talking to a client of ours last night. They've recently been relocated to a regional town in South Australia. He's got himself a job with the council, and they've done. They did a great job. They went out and they had a look, and they had Paul and Tony went and had a look at the actual local market, and they thought, well, they don't probably want to put their money in this local market, and they wanted to get some feedback to see whether I validated that. I did validate it. I said, absolutely, this is not the market that we put our owner-occupied money into, so we're going to be rent vesters. And I used that word to them, and Tony just burst out laughing. She thought it was hilarious, and she said she's going to get T-shirts made. So we are rent vesters. And I thought, that's great. That's fantastic. And she said, she'll send one to me. Well, I do own an owner-occupied home, or my wife does, so I probably can't wear that T-shirt.
You can wear it, mate.
But absolutely, it's usually domain of younger people who are looking to get on the property ladder who still might be at home. But rent vesting is like, well, I'm going to rent, live where I want to live, and buy investment properties.
Mate, you could wear that T-shirt. You've worn a surfing shirt before, mate. You don't go surfing.
Yeah, that's to keep the melanomas off my back.
All right, so here it is. Loving your podcast. Keep up the great work. As you mentioned, there are so many areas to discuss regarding property investing. Like yourself, I'm an enthusiast and happy to talk about it for days. As a topic, I'd love for you to discuss one of your podcasts is for the investor, him or herself, to buy and live in their own PPR or to rent, PPR being principal place of residence. Obviously, both have advantages, a place to call home or the ability to keep investing without losing potential borrowing capacity. I'd love to hear your thoughts, as we'll have to cross this road for myself shortly. So the old rent money is dead money, Ben, is largely, in my view, a baby boomer and previous generation term. Mm. Gen X and Gen Y are more likely to embrace this, but effectively it's the cash flow advantages that come from renting in a lifestyle location, mm-hmm. probably closer to the city, but if it's the ocean or the river, where the person who owns the property's got a larger mortgage and you're actually helping them pay it off. So you don't compromise on your lifestyle, but you're also putting your money to work somewhere else. So for example, a family who has two young kids, a two-bedroom apartment close to the city would make for a great investment, generally. I've got to unpack that a bit more, but generally speaking.
Yep.
But a family with two kids generally couldn't easily live in a two-bedroom apartment.
No, that's right. So it works really well where you've got your price ranges around the million plus range, because the ratio of yield, in other words, the percentage of rent that you would get for a property or you pay for a property to rent versus the repayment on the mortgage, it's that differential. So if your yield is, say, 1.5% on the actual value of the property that you're living in and the mortgage of the day is 4.5%, what have we got? 3% difference. Mm. So it's that 3% that you take as surplus cash flow and go off and invest that money. Mm. That is the classic rent vester in terms of their model. So it's not people staying at home and starting out on the property ladder. It's basically taking that opportunity and making sure that you're not just paying dead money for rent, you're actually reinvesting that money and taking the step forward.
I think the important point with rent vesting is on paper, most things being equal, it actually makes sense financially to consider being a rent vester. What it doesn't take into account, the emotional, objectives of someone wanting to touch their own wall, put their own pictures on their own walls and those sorts of things. So that's kind of the balance between financial objectives and emotional objectives.
That's right. So if we look at the investment return, what's happening here is we know the models are in. You can run any type of model. If you rented for your entire life and trapped that surplus and invested it. Because what's happening is two things. One is the tenant and potentially the tax man is actually helping you pay for that property. So your out-of-pocket is lower. So it just means you've got deductibility on some of the loans that you're taking and you've got the tenant paying that particular property off for you. So there's the combination. It's a combination of trapping the surplus, the tenant and the tax man helping you acquire that property. And from that point of view, you're on your way.
That was a message or a question from Ryan Key. So hopefully that helps you with the upcoming decision that you have to make, Ryan. And we'd love for you to maybe send us a little note to let us know how you actually went with that decision. All right, as we hit the close to sign off mode, we'll try and sneak one more in. The question is regarding next wage growth hotspot. Hi guys, very much enjoying the podcast. An interesting point of discussion for future shows may be around income growth in different areas of Australia. I believe the tailwinds in the previous two decades of financial deregulation, increase in household debt and interest rates trending down will not be repeated. Therefore, asset selection will be crucial going forward as there won't be the rising tide to lift all ships. Sounds like someone's been listening to our podcast.
I think they understand us very well.
As mentioned on previous podcasts, investors will want to avoid glass ceilings in terms of cap wage growth in certain areas. Given the changing economy, are there particular areas of Australia in which you expect to see wage growth occurring? Perhaps if you could contrast inner city suburb wage growth with regional areas over the next few decades, it might make for a good topic of discussion. I could see you salivating at the thought of giving some input here.
How long have I got?
Yeah, that's right.
I could talk about this for an hour. So I've got to try and summarise it into 2 minutes.
I'll give you 3.5.
Okay, thanks. All right. So the first thing we start off with is statistically we know that the higher wage growth occurs in the elite suburbs. So we know that where wages live is the most expensive real estate in Australia. And it's a good marriage because obviously having high incomes means you can afford these houses, you can borrow the money and basically secure the homes. Now we also know that the percentage of income that these professionals get is usually higher than the average worker,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So when we know that the bosses give the bosses bigger pay rises than their workers, and they sit around the board and work out their own bonuses, that's what happens, okay? So in reality, to answer part of your question, David, the areas that have the biggest, strongest growth in incomes are the already established areas that have the biggest and strongest growth for incomes. So those blue chip areas are always going to be phenomenally supported and they will always give you the best returns if you can afford to get into them. Now, that being said, there are areas that gentrify. And it's those areas that gentrify that will also have uplift opportunity, whereby you will get a greater or superior return, or what I call an outperform return, on your property selection based on the fact that these areas are bringing in middle managers or managers of mid-cap to small-sized businesses that will come into those locations and earn their six-figure salaries, as opposed to the elite suburbs where it's, you know, household incomes are around the $300,000 to $500,000 range. These household incomes are around the $150,000 to $300,000 range. And it's those areas closer to the employment centres that have the strong amenity that will actually gentrify quicker than the outer suburb areas where the people who are buying those properties are usually the lower skilled and lower qualified people, and they're buying out there because of the affordability reason, and that's why they have inferior growth in the value of their properties.
That there is.
How did I go?
You did really well because that's your passion. You're keen to find out the science that underpins. Because let's be honest, as Peter said when we were in Adelaide, he goes, most people are buying residential real estate to live in.
Yep.
The majority aren't buying it to invest in.
Yeah, we're price takers, not price makers. We know that 70% of the population is owner-occupied. You've heard me say that before. And so as in traditional established marketplaces like big cities, we should be the price taker, not the price maker. So what's happening in Sydney, that's why we're not a big believer in Sydney at the moment, is because when you get 50% of the 50% of the new owners coming in as investors, unsustainable, there will be a correction in that market.
Well, that's what we chased in Adelaide, wasn't it?
Yep.
We've got a city that's got less than the average in population,
yep.
Less than the average in terms of population growth.
Yep.
Industry, it was interesting, we were in the car with someone who said that their children had reached a certain point where they wanted to move interstate, yep. to chase bigger incomes. Yep. And that's the challenge for Adelaide.
Yep. That's the brain drain that goes out of those cities.
But ultimately, what we were doing is we're trying to narrow down very quickly on two things. We asked to go through the suburbs where the big money was.
Yep.
You know, the Unleys. I can't remember the name of the suburb we were in that just had some gargantuan houses.
They Victoria Avenue. What an amazing street of properties. So we've seen the very best of what Adelaide has to offer. And it comes back to that point. There's still surgeons in Adelaide. There's still senior litigators, lawyers, accountants,
dentists,
farmers who have made, you have fabulously large farms worth millions. Mm. So there's that old money, and then there's that flush of new money coming in, the foreign money that potentially comes in. So there's still opportunity in these marketplaces. So if someone says to me, why would you go to Adelaide when the average household income is the third lowest across Australia?
Mm.
Well, the reality is it's still got lifestyle elements, still got fantastic weather, it's still got good amenity, and in some cases it's got a better pace of life, better quality of living, better mix of student to teacher education, lower. So there's those types of things that can potentially attract those people. Because what Pete did also say is that they leave in their early 20s and they come back in their early 30s when they want to settle down and have their family. So the reality is that this, you know, you don't have a city that survives for 150 to 200 years without knowing it's got sustainability to it. So it's about timing the market and being that borderless investor.
Yep. And it was important to remember when we jumped on the plane, we talked about you're not buying Adelaide. You're buying a piece of real estate, one piece of real estate in a city of thousands and thousands and thousands of submarkets. So you're just really looking for the gems that are chasing the income, which is what this question is all about that we got from David. So there you go, folks. The next growth hotspot really comes down to studying the incomes. If you find an area where, for example, like the Silicon Valley in America, where there's a big concentration of computer geeks who are moving to a certain spot and they decided they were going to move to Uluru, for example, but they could still control their income, there may be a chance that that real estate market would do well. But ultimately, it's unpacking and understanding the demographic of the people, where they're moving to, what sort of incomes they got, and what opportunity do they have next year of being in control of their income rather than just letting general inflation be in control of their income.
Yeah, because there's all of these great areas, it's very rare that income actually declines. You might lose your bonuses if the share market's had a bad year, and it might soften values at that elite top end, in the, you know, sort of 5 to 10 million bracket, and even the 3 to 5 million bracket. But, you know, with a median house price in some cities of $1 million, well, I still don't believe the data's probably a bit mixed up on that, but my view is it's still lower than that. But in reality, what we're talking about here is a classic case of incomes usually grow greater in those areas. So go where the money's.
Go where the money is. There you go, folks. You've heard it here from the Property Investment Advisor of the Year. Go where the money is. All right, three questions. I'm pretty impressed that we got through three questions, which is pretty good. Now, you'll notice I didn't start the podcast talking about tips because, Ben, you actually beat me this week, and now you're number 31 in the whole country.
I don't want to brag, Bryce. I don't want to brag. Oh, 31 out of almost 500,000 tips. Just joking.
I had a shocking week. I was number one for all season, and now you've come and done a Steve Bradbury on me. So,
a long way to go. Still six rounds. Yes. So, I don't worry. I've learned to botch it from this point forward.
So, a big shout out to the listeners to help me with my tips, just to make sure that Ben doesn't beat me by the end of the season. So, okay. So, we talked about building and pest inspections today. We talked about rent vesting today, and we've also talked about wage growth hotspots. The word hotspot in property investing is equivalent to diets on the front page of the women's magazines, in my view. Everyone loves a good hotspot. So this week, we've been getting some great questions. We've also been getting some great reviews, just to prove that they aren't, you know, we're not in the real world, Ben. Someone just gave us a 2 out of 5 review.
Obviously, they love our work.
We've been getting lots of great reviews. Someone gave us a 2 out of 5. So to that person, if they want to send us a little email to tell us how we can improve, we're certainly open to...
Open to constructive criticism.
Absolutely. We're open to constructive criticism. So if you're not following us on our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, please do that. The Property Couch hashtags and all that sort of stuff. We're also going to put... I've done a video that we're going to put up on the propertycouch.com.au about why you should get a building and pest inspection. And Ben's also done a video on rent vesting. So there you go, folks. There's a couple of extra resources for you that you can go to thepropertycouch.com.au to go and get for yourself. So, Ben, we got through a lot.
We did.
It's always the best part of our week. But I just wondered if you did a little bit of homework about. Are we going to sign off internationally, or are we put you under too much pressure?
I'm trying to find the one that I wanted to do, but I can't seem to find it. How bad am I going at the moment? This is what's called preparation and professionalism, everyone.
Well, to our Greek listeners last week, I wonder if we actually got the Greek sign off right. But
oh no, that wouldn't happen. So,
well, whilst you're doing that, I'm just going to let the folks know. Next week, we're going to be talking about exit strategy. If you're investing in property, you need to have your exit strategy in mind. Stephen Covey said, begin with the end in mind is one of his 7 habits of highly effective people. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. We're going to start with the end in mind regarding exit strategy. So it's been a good week, Ben. It's been fun being in Adelaide. It's been fun getting through some of these questions. So until next week.
In Portuguese, adios, amigo.
Adios, amigo. There we go, folks. We'll see you next week. Thanks for coming on.